It is time for the Arsenal of Freedom Show podcast. I am your host, Jake Reed, and today is 4/24/2024, almost a palindrome day, but not quite. Today we're going to be talking about Intro to Permaculture. This is a podcast episode that I've been working on for a very long time, since the summer of 2016, actually, when I did a presentation for some folks right after Harambe died, you know, and the Orange Man was running. The world was in chaos, much as it is today. But in order to give you what I believe to be one of the best tools in your arsenal of freedom, which is food freedom, the ability to grow your own food, the ability to think like a permaculture design operator, or a permaculture designer, as we call ourselves. So I'm just going to start off. You may hear some background noise. My neighbors are doing some roofing. I've actually sealed off the room as best as I can. So here we go. Introduction to permaculture. You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. That's a quote by Buckminster Fuller, who's basically the architect who invented the geodesic dome. And the Buckyball is actually named after Buckminster Fuller. But we're not going to talk about just great men who lived and died. We're going to talk about the three ethics and the prime directive of permaculture. So the prime directive of permaculture is much like the prime directive in Star Trek. It is the first thing that you guide your principles on, and that prime directive is the only ethical decision is to take responsibility for our own existence and that of our children. And that's by Bill Mollison, one of the two founders of permaculture. And the three ethics fold into the prime directive. And those are, in order, care of earth, care of people, and return of surplus to the first two. It's also called set limits to population and consumption by some circles. But either way, you're taking that surplus of your care of earth, care of people, and you're returning it to the first two ethics. So what's the first thing you do when you get onto a piece of property or you're analyzing a situation? Well, you observe and interact. So you look at your surroundings and you interact with them. So that's one of the first laws. Next is the law of return. Whatever we take, we must replace. Soil fertility, nitrogen, potassium, carbon. Those things go back into the system. We're talking about agriculture here, but these principles can be applied to anything from business to any aspect of your personal freedom. Next, we want to work with rather than against nature. Nature will put weeds of all types in our systems and our lives in general. And we want to figure out why they're there and what we can use them for. Now, what is a weed? A weed is anything that's there that we didn't put there. So if that's in your life, in your garden, in your business, in your whatever area you're applying this to, because this permaculture applies to everything. It comes from the words permanent and agriculture, but it's really permanent and culture. So we want to create a semi-permanent to permanent, indelible culture. And then another thing that we always say is the problem is the solution. And we want to find ways to turn those negative situations into positive ones, or even the very solution that can be the problem. So if you have a long commute, you might start listening to a business podcast on the way, or you might get in your car and start a podcast like some of us in the community have. And then you want to make the least change for the greatest possible effort or effect. You don't want to be putting a ton of human effort into whatever you're doing. You want to make automated systems. And I'm not just talking about computer automation, although that has expanded greatly even since I did this presentation in 2016. Like you can use a Raspberry Pi and sensors and all kinds of things for your garden. But think about your actions on a daily basis. We call a zone zero. We call it inside your house. And we'll talk about zones here in a little bit, but you get up, you go where? And then you do what? And you go to bed at night, and you do where? Where do you go to bed? What do you do? You want to be thinking along those lines. And so types of resources that are unaffected by use. Oxygen that you breathe turns into CO2 is consumed by plants. That's unaffected by use. Resources that increase with modest use, like grazing or any type of life biology, like worm composting or which we call vermicomposting. Then there's resources that disappear or degrade if not used. Unharvested fruit on a fruit tree is a good example that falls to the ground, attracts certain pests. We might be able to break the pest cycle with chickens. I've not seen that quite happen. Usually you have to create a barrier in between your home and your unharvested fruit on a fruit tree. And then there's resources that are reduced by use. Finite metals, oil, minerals, things that we have to mine rather than farm. And when we're talking about business or life, sometimes we treat people like they're finite resources. And in a sense that they are. We all have a finite lifespan. But we don't want to reduce them by use. We want to improve and regenerate them by use. Next, we have things that pollute or destroy with use. Burning fossil fuels or nuclear reactants. Now, here's the caveat. Pollution is always a sign of an overabundance of resources. Everything from thorium reactor, you know, the liquid fluoride thorium reactors to, you know, the nuclear plants that might power your own home right now. And we're going to get into some solar topics and stuff here in a little bit. Next up, we have energy. We want to get as much use out of a thing or a resource as possible. So if there's water on your property, try to make it take the lowest, slowest, longest path to reduce erosion and get the most out of it while it's on your property. We can use things called swales, which are basically a ditch on contour, and contour is 90 degrees. So think of a castle moat. If you're on a hill and you've got all the castle, you know, the castle moats, like a Mott and Bailey castle. But what if you're not on a castle? What if you're in a trailer park? Or what if you're on very flat land, like where I live, out in the desert? We think that everything is flat. Well, I can pretty much guarantee you, unless you're living at the bottom of the Dead Sea or Salt Lake City, you're not on flat land. You're on some sort of a slope. And you should hope you're on some sort of a slope, otherwise your house will flood every single time it rains. And so with that, we take those functions and we stack those functions. So everything should have as many uses as possible. It's a principle for both survivalism and permaculture, because the roof on your house can shield you from the weather, and you can use the hard surface to collect rainwater. It can serve as a place to put your solar panels and other ways to harvest energy. And then we go through cycles. Most systems have a cycle from pioneering through climax and diminishment. They will produce different yields along the way. Corn produces shade, a food yield, and then decays into carbon again. So I like to personally grow Blue Hopi Indian corn. That's what they call it here. And you kind of have to plant it around August, like early August, August 1st, to get it into the ground. But it only grows up about 4 or 5 feet. But you know at the end of it, you're going to get corn husks. And if you don't use those, the birds will come and eat them. But if you do use those, you could maybe make tamales and use the corn husks for that, even if you don't eat corn. Like I know a lot of us in the community don't eat carbohydrates much anymore. And here's something about diversity. Don't add diversity and complexity for the sake of diversity and complexity alone. Each element in your system should be there because it's either naturally occurring or you chose to put it there. Now, diversity can add to stability. If one crop fails, others might make up for it. If one element can reinforce another, rabbits fertilizing a garden, and some of them might take a harvest from that garden, that's one way to increase diversity in your systems. But when we think about systems thinking in general, systems thinking applies to everything. So in your zone one, which is your basically your garden where everywhere you walk during a day, this is kind of the kitchen garden. This might be where you actually do some of these regenerative agriculture purposes, regenerative agriculture techniques, I should say. And then that leads us into components of design. Water, earth, landscape, climate, plants, animals, social components, which are people, culture, economy, the legal system that you're currently structured in, energy components, technologies, structures, tools, and abstract components like ethics, timing, and data. And each element has input needs. Every element in your system has needs. If it's a living thing, such as a chicken would need food, water, shelter, calcium supplements like oyster shells or even eggshells for their own nutrition, so that they don't end up eating their own eggs. Because they will do that if you have chickens. If you don't have chickens and maybe you're an apartment dweller, you might not use all of this, but every person has a zone zero. And maybe I should write a book on zone zero, because zone zero is like the least talked about zone in permaculture. But we'll get there. And actually, ironically, the next slide is concept and methods, which includes zone and sector analysis. And zones are concentric circles around your central dwelling that represent usage in time. In reality, it's never a circle. The closest thing to an actual circle is the electromagnetic spectrum of your essence, but that's a little bit too philosophical for permaculture. Sectors are directional sections from which outside elements can flow into your system. Sunlight, traffic noise, good views, bad views, dust. And then here's my favorite zone, zone zero. It's inside your home. But when we talk about zone zero in this podcast, we're talking about your core essence of your core being, of your core freedom. And so you take this permaculture framework and you start with zero. Programmers, as I am one, we count from zero. So that's inside you. Zone one is an area which you likely or necessarily go to every day. Your kitchen garden, chickens. Most urban homes are 100% in zone one. Mine is probably has a little bit more zone one and zone two, because I live on a quarter acre. But most like HOA type homes, you're only going to have a zone one. Zone two would be main crop beds, orchards, ranging animals. I don't have a zone two. I do have a kitchen garden set up, but I don't have a ton of fruit trees yet, because I spent the last 9 years basically building the swale from scratch by hand and not using sort of backhoes and excavators because I didn't want to deal with all of that. So it really depends on your situation. And then zone three would be broad scale farming. Like you're on acres with tractors and you're pulling in, you know, bushels of wheat or whatever, you know, a main crop that you sell by the pound to somebody. And then zones four and five is a blurry line, because zone five is unmanaged wooded or natural areas. So think state land or places where you might be able to go hunting or fishing. And then zone four is a slightly managed, like a mushroom farm or a woodlot. You might actually own the property, but it's on the edge of state land, so maybe people or animals come into your property, and depending on your regulations, Arizona is very strict with our game management, probably more so than the Midwest. We have tons of migratory species. We have, you know, we're in the Sonoran Desert, so we have tons of endangered species. That leads us into patterns. And patterns are pretty much a huge part of permaculture. It would fill multiple textbooks. I can recommend a few in the show notes. The Permaculture Designer's Manual is kind of the Bible of permaculture. That you can get from the Permaculture Research Institute of Australia. And it's published in, I think it's still published in New Zealand, but I have to double check. I got my permaculture design certificate in 2013. So it's kind of brushing up on the material as I go. So some simple patterns. Spiral pattern is used as an herb spiral. So there's some pictures, but to describe this in audio, and I'm going to put the presentation up for download if possible. But an herb spiral is essentially a hill of dirt, and you would walk up it with a spiral, and you might put bricks or rocks or something, and then you put the driest loving herbs at the top and the wettest loving herbs at the bottom, and then you could put your automated drip irrigation. And then swales along contour, capturing a natural pattern of the land. Every situation is different. So I can only describe what I've seen. You have to sort of walk your own property and put in what you want. And maybe you don't want. Like maybe you want to remove things, but that's, we have a joke in permaculture. The answer is it depends, because nobody knows your situation like you do. And there's another pattern, the dendrite pattern. It's branching. It's like a tree or a river. It's actually, we use it in neuroscience, the dendrites of the brain. So you want to think about a branching pattern. And the point of patterns is to observe them and see how you can use them effectively. Because patterns create edges, and edges are the boundaries between two mediums. And they're the most productive in a system. Like anytime you've seen a curb, there's more grass on those edges than there is everywhere else, because nutrient flows into those edges, and then it will often cause what we call weeds. But if you identify those weeds, you could either compost them, or maybe they're edible, maybe you could harvest them, but that's something that you would have to research on the ground in the moment. And here I'm just going to read some of the specific techniques in the permaculturist's toolbox. The swale that I've been talking about. And this is a ditch on contour. Contour is the level line on a piece of land. The ditch runs parallel with the level, and the mound of dirt goes downhill. This lets water slowly seep across the landscape through the soil rather than causing erosion. So there's some good pictures in the PowerPoint presentation. And then we're going to talk about hügelkultur. Now, this is a sort of a German word. It was invented by Sepp Holzer and popularized by Paul Wheaton from richsoil.com. A hügelkultur bed is a wood cored high bed. The wood absorbs water and breaks down with fungus, providing a water sponge and nutrient silo for the plants to thrive. So what that essentially means is the wood core is going to turn in, it's going to rot. But you, and you don't use this to stop water at all, because you will wash, it will wash away with rain, and I really wouldn't advise that. Now, there's two techniques to use with this: hugel culture and wood cored beds. And you can use time stacking with hugel culture. You can throw compost and soil and twigs and grasses and wood and on top of these big wood core. Just think of like cordwood, like you were, like you would use for a fireplace, and you just stack that up along, I wouldn't say a long contour so much, because this is going to wash away if you have big floodplains. But for the average suburban home, you want to use something called more of a wood cord bed. And then you can irrigate on it. And it really depends on where you are and how much rainfall you get. As somebody who lives deep within the desert, my number one priority is water retention. As somebody who might live in Alaska or Michigan, your number one priority is going to be solar hours and snow and keeping things warm. Well, it's a lot easier to generate hot than it is to generate cold because of a thermodynamic equation. And that kind of brings me into the rocket mass heater. And this is another invention very much popularized by Mr. Paul Wheaton. And rocket mass heaters burn wood efficiently by burning it very hot and with maximum combustion. The exhaust isn't very smoky at all, and most of the energy is converted to heat. The thermal mass absorbs the heat and radiates it throughout the day. So in the diagram, it's very much a cross section. But in reality, you want to think about this as like a couch covered in cob and thermal mass. You're using the fire to heat stone and stucco and whatever. You're not heating the air. And it uses a principle called wood gasification, where it gets the wood so hot that it basically turns into like a natural gas. Now, Paul colloquially calls this boom squish when you mix water and fire in a compressed container. Kaboom. Boom squish. So I would recommend checking out his fire science videos if you want to learn more. And I'll link Rich Soil and permies.com in the show notes. But that's where you want to find Paul. And then the herb spiral, which I kind of already described, but now I've got a technical definition. Driest loving herbs on top, wetter loving herbs down from there. It's an aesthetic and functional design. And there's some beautiful pictures, sketches. You can just Google or DuckDuckGo or whatever search engine you use the term herb spiral, and you can get some inspiration. And next up is time and function stacking. Time stacking is placing elements at the appropriate times so that they will be matured when other elements need them, like planting a tree or a three sisters garden, which is corn, squash, and beans, and letting the corn grow a bit first, which shades the beans, and then that can grow up along the stalks if we're talking about a pole bean rather than a bush bean. And then finally you'd plant a squash for shade. Like here in Phoenix, we really love the crookneck yellow squash, and I've been growing this since I was a little kid. And I've actually got some secrets to grow the perfect yellow squash. And one of those is using spirulina and kelp as a fertilizer. Soil amendments will make yellow squash grow amazingly. And function stacking is multiple uses for a single element. So it's not quite multitasking, but it's multiple use. So probably the best example in our modern world is the smartphone. We have essentially a NASA supercomputer in our pockets if we have a smartphone. We can use that to video record. We could audio record a podcast. Now, it might not have the audio quality that this podcast does, but there's the cross-section of both time and function stacking, and that's where efficiency comes into play. I do this a lot. I have outdoor laundry, so I can set up the laundry to be running while I record the podcast. And you don't get to hear my laundry running, hopefully. But today you're probably going to be hearing some banging from the roofers. And so collecting rainwater in rain barrels is another element. Storing it off of your roof and storing it in those 55-gallon rain barrels, or maybe your HOA or your local government ordinance. Like, I know that there were some issues in Colorado for a long time about storing rainwater in rain barrels, but I think that they've gotten that issue amended now. We call that a type 1 error when you do something that your local ordinance prevents you to do. So you don't want to do that. And you want to make sure that the bottom of your barrel is as high as possible, higher than the highest point you want to run water to. So think of water towers. We use a lot of energy to pump water up so that we have water pressure out. But as long as you have sufficient water pressure, you can make drip irrigation happen from rainwater. And you can run these barrels in parallel, much like you would run electricity in parallel. I'm looking at the picture now, and there's five blue barrels, and there's a PVC line underneath this. Now, this is just a picture that I found, so I'm trying to describe it as best as I can, but it all depends on your situation. Do you have gutter systems? And then next, I'd like to talk about earth bag construction. This has kind of always been a dream of mine, to build an earth bag house. And what you end up with is essentially those bags that rice comes in, or burlap, I guess you could use as well. Very cheap material cost, but very high labor cost, because you're getting people to literally fill bags with earth. And this would work great out in Phoenix, but probably terrible in somewhere like Alaska or maybe even Michigan, because you don't have the dust that we have. But it's very high insulation and storm resistance. And the whole thing is renewable except for the bags. They use poly bags, but if you used burlap and you constructed it correctly, and then you covered it with stucco or something like that, you could make basically a house that's modern in design, but the insulation would be so good. We're talking like R45 levels of insulation if you're into construction at all. And another element is composting. And I used to think that this was such a no-brainer that you shouldn't even mention it in an introduction to permaculture. But what I've learned about composting, from doing it in my backyard with my dad to doing it on my own to seeing it in action on property, people need to learn this technique. So a friend of mine has a composting class at homefoodsystems.com, and I'm going to put a shout out in the links. But the website is homefoodsystems.com, and he is basically the person who taught me a lot about composting, other than my father. And you generally need a cubic meter of brown and green material to get a good compost started. Now, brown material is something that's high in carbon, like cardboard or eggshells, things that are not meat, but yeah, not meat or vegetables, scraps. That's what brown elements are. And then green elements are things that are very high nitrogen. So apples, apple cores, you know, vegetable material. And the highest nitrogen source is meat. And they'll tell you you can't compost meat. You can, with a but. You need to get that compost cooking. And you need about a cubic meter to do it. Like, once you have all... We use this method in the desert called layered compost, where you just take your kitchen scraps, your greens, your actual vegetable scraps, and you take your browns, like whatever cardboard or whatever, and every day you just kind of layer it until you get that cubic meter. Then once you get that cubic meter, you pull it off of that pile or that area, and you can get to work and get started. And you want to wet it pretty much every day. Apparently, you can get it done in about 28 days. That sounds about right. Grass clippings and leaves are two of the best amendments to composting. But to do this in an organic manner, you want to stay away from your Roundups and your all the commercial weed killers. And I think that could be an entire episode on its own. But this is sort of more of an intro to permaculture. So I'll stop there and just send you off to that bioreactor composting course. And at the end here, I'm going to kind of give myself a shout out. I had an Instructables that I did that made a YouTube video years ago on how to make a raised bed garden box from wood pallets. And for whatever reason, this is the thing that went viral. So I'm going to link that in the show notes again and sort of bring attention to it. But going around and finding pallets from industrial areas that are they're at the dumpster, they set them out for people to take. Now you want to look for pressure treated, not the stuff that has asbestos in it. And there's different symbols that you can look up. You might want to do your own research on that. But the pressure-treated lumber is safe to use for garden beds. And what I always do is I just rip out the nails and try to get the square, get the boxes as square as possible. And these things will last a decade if done right. And last but not least, I have some pictures of my property before and after, like basically right as I bought my property, just a sort of a screenshot of how barren and desert it looked, and then a very recent one of how green it is. Because one of the inspirations for permaculture for me was the movie Greening the Desert that Jeff Lawton did. It's one of the reasons why I decided to take a permaculture design certificate course. So it takes time. Permaculture is permanent. It's indelible. It's something you place, and in order to remove it, you would take a lot of effort. But in the end, it's worth it, because our lives should be as indelible as possible. So take it, make it your own, make it a great day.